Welcome back to The Late Set. My name is Nate Chenin.
And I'm Josh Jackson. And that's some great music from Terrence Blanchard and E Collective. Nate, these guys have been together for 10 years now.
That went by quickly.
Yeah, it did.
I am always interested in whatever Terrence Blanchard is putting down.
Yeah. You know?
And it's fun when we can have someone on the show who I think you could fairly say, like, we're friends.
Yeah.
Friend, not just friend of the pod, but friend of Josh Jackson. You know, it's weird for me as a critic to call him a friend. I think I can, though. It's been cool to watch him continue to grow as an artist and as a sort of doer of things in the world.
Yeah. And now as a grandfather and all the things. Yeah. Counting on, more than 25 years now of knowing both he and his wife, Robin. Mm-hmm. And he's always been someone who's been very supportive of me. And I always appreciated that. I always appreciate, too, that he's doing all those incredible things. You know, he was at the Exit Zero Jazz Festival. That's where WRTI and The Late Set set up shop. And had a delightful conversation, you and I, with Terrence.
If every interview for the show could be held on a beautiful day on the beach,
yeah,
I would not be mad.
I'm game.
This was a particularly beautiful day, you know. We had some breezes. But yeah, just idyllic. And I really loved this conversation because we got into a lot of stuff, including some of his experience interacting with institutions, both as the leader of SF Jazz, artistic director there now, and as a featured artist, composer at the Metropolitan Opera, where he made history as the first Black operatic composer to have work presented. Something that he does not take lightly, but also his phrase, which you'll hear him say, is that, you know, I don't want to be a token. I want to be a turnkey,
yeah.
Which is a beautiful, little metaphor there, but he means it.
You and I had a great opportunity to go to the Met and to witness Champion.
Yeah.
And I have to say that was a really great night, even though I almost lost my cell phone back pocket.
Yeah.
But, Terrence is just a real champion for the music.
So this reminds me of something. We are, as a culture, commemorating the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. You know, it was, a little while ago now that the actual anniversary came and went.
August 29th, 2005. It's seared in my brain.
Yeah, yeah. So here's the weird segue that I will say, which is, you mentioned Champion, and it reminds me. So I had been writing about Terrence Blanchard for years by this point, but after Hurricane Katrina, he made an album called Katrina, A Tale of God's Will. And I decided this was a really good opportunity to profile him for the New York Times, write about this work he's doing, write about his connection to his hometown. And so I went down to New Orleans, I think for 4 days. And Terrence and Robin were very generous with the access. They said, yeah, just tag along, come see what we're doing. At that time, he was teaching as part of the Monk Institute at Loyola.
That's right.
And so I really did sort of embed with him. And I went to Loyola. I watched him work with the students. I watched him, go around. He drove me all around town and showed me, places where he used to hang out as a kid. We went to the Maple Leaf and heard Rebirth late one night.
Tuesday nights.
We had multiple dinners. And here's where the Champion thing comes in. I went to his gym and watched him work out with his trainer.
Oh, nice.
Spent a whole afternoon watching him, sparring. His trainer told me, he pulled me aside. He's like, he's really good. Like, if he wanted to do this, like, he's a good boxer. There is a kind of authority in Champion that I think comes from his real affinity for the ring.
I agree.
So, but you know, I mentioned Katrina. You have an even deeper experience
with
this whole thing and your connection with Terrence. So let's talk about that.
Well, I'll very quickly gloss over the experience just because it was deeply affecting my mother, who lived in New Orleans at that time. And I lost some valuable records too, but I don't want to go there. Mm. But I will say that when A Tale of God's Will came out, at that time I was doing a lot of contributing to NPR Music, and they had basically at that time a brand new website, and they were just kind of looking for stuff to put on it.
Yeah, right.
You know, it was at that stage, you know, we built this thing, now what goes on it? And, you know, before the Tiny Desk concerts and all this stuff. And so I recommended to Anya Grundman, who was the executive at the time, you know, how about I go down and hang out with Terrence Blanchard and we'll just go to a studio and, you know, he can play some of the themes and talk about, you know, making the music for that album. You know, so we went to a studio uptown and he sat at the piano and played some of the music. And, you know, we had some really, really deep conversations about, you know, same kind of thing you were doing, him growing up in Pontchartrain Park and just the things that we lost, mm-hmm. you know, and that was fresh then.
Yeah.
You know? Now we're looking at it 20 years later and it's a different sense, but the loss was still the same, mm-hmm. you know? So, yeah, I mean, it was a beautiful moment. It was sad. It was, you know, I think it was a thing that just we understood as people who, you know, spent a lot of time in New Orleans, you know, how much it meant, how much the city means, not just to us, but to most people in America, mm-hmm. if they know what came out of it.
Yeah. You know. Well, he's carried that with him and, you know, the tragedy of it. Also, in some cases, led to opportunity. In his case, I think it truly did sort of deepen his connection with the cultural community of that city. I mean, it couldn't have been any deeper before, but it did. It got deeper, you know. Yeah. And he has continued, you know, even as he is, you know, doing things in New York and, you know, out on the West Coast, like he is still, that bond runs endlessly deep.
Well, I tell you one thing, this was a great conversation at the Exit Zero Jazz Festival. Anytime we get to hang out with Terrence Blanchard is a good time. And I hope that you enjoy this talk as much as we did when we were doing it.
Welcome to the Late Set.
Hey.
We are so happy to be here. We're so happy you're here. And we're especially happy to be sitting down with the great Terrence Blanchard. Hey. So how about a hand for Terrence?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
There are so many. It's funny, you know, Josh and Terrence go back a long, long time. Terrence and I go back a ways, mm-hmm. and there's so much we can talk about.
Yes.
I thought that since we are here at this wonderful festival, and Terrence is now the artistic director at SF Jazz, and we have another festival coming up, the San Francisco Jazz Festival in mid-June. So I thought maybe let's start by talking about curation.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And, you know, what it's been like for you stepping into that role. That wonderful organization, and thinking about festivals and thinking about, you know, a concert season, what is the biggest sort of unexpected lesson that you've learned stepping in?
Well, I think for me, one of the things that I've learned immediately is how, with all of our good intentions, sometimes we don't necessarily hear what the public is asking for. For example, we had an open house at SF Jazz, where we just opened the doors. We had some instruments on stage. We had cameras going so people could see themselves on the screen. We had a lot of stuff going around in the building. And what we found out was there were a lot of people in the neighborhood. It was their first time ever coming into the building, you know, and that shouldn't be for a community-based organization, you know. So that got me thinking about the festival. Our festival prior to that was 40 concerts within 10 days inside the building. And to me, that doesn't feel like a festival. Coming from New Orleans, as you guys know, Josh, you've been there, you worked there, you've seen it. And I remember being here during the COVID year when we were outside. Engaging a community is the most important thing for me with a festival. It's like getting everybody engaged and having shared moments, you know, whether it be with food or music or whatever. Music is the catalyst that drives the entire thing. But, you know, we need arts and crafts from the local artists, food trucks from the local vendors and stuff like that. And we decided to take it out into the streets. And we're excited about what's going to happen. We're only doing one weekend this year. It's our first year. We want to see exactly what all of this entails. Because, you know, we have a lot of great ideas and good intentions, but that doesn't necessarily mean they come to fruition. So, but with that, having said that, I'm really proud of the lineup of people. We have, you know, Brandon Woody's going to be there. Tatiana Tate's going to be there. We're bringing Patrice Rushen doing her own thing. And the reason why I'm excited about that is because she's probably one of the most underrated power people in the music business. You know, she was a woman doing stuff in the 70s that no women were doing and doing it at a high level. You know what I mean? So I'm excited about having her there. Man, I can't think of everybody we're going to have there. We're going to have Charles Lloyd there. So we're excited about that, you know. And then just in terms of curation, I'm learning about the power that we have as an organization. And I'll give you an example. We have the main room, Minor, which seats about 700 people. And then we have a small room, JHL, which seats about 120 people. So there's a big gap in between. And some of the guys that I talked to, they never played SF Jazz. And it was because they were too big to play JHL, but not big enough to do Minor. So when I started to realize that there was an issue there, we started a series. It's called Upswing. And what Upswing is designed to do is to give those mid-level guys a chance to play in Minor. And we do double bills to kind of help show that, make sure that we can have a full house, right? But here's the thing that I love about you guys, patrons who love this music, right? When you tell them that it's new artists, that it's an up and coming next generation, they've all responded. All of those shows have been selling out. So the idea is to build a relationship with these young artists, with our client base, so that they can one day do Minor by themselves. And having the realization of being able to help the community in that way, it's got me excited about a whole bunch of other things that we want to do as well. Thank you.
You know, Terrence, one of the struggles that big institutions have, and now you're part of a big institution with SF Jazz, you know, is the difference between building community versus building audience.
Yes.
And, mm-hmm. you know, for a very long time, especially performing arts organizations mm-hmm. have been very focused on building audience and yes. trying to get butts in seats.
Yes.
But I think we're learning more and more these days that building the community that you want to serve and mm-hmm. that you want to be a part of yes. is far more important and also far more healthy for not only the total ecosystem, but also for the organization itself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, you know, now that you're in this seat, you know, what is the community that you wish to build and how do you want to be reflected within it?
Well, look, there's a community of music lovers all over the globe. Those are the people that I'm trying to reach out to. You hit it right on the head, Josh, because when I got to SF Jazz, man, it's like a Ferrari. It's been successful. They've been putting a lot of seats, butts in seats and everything. But some of the curation kind of pushed away a certain audience. And what we're trying to do is we want to make sure that we're letting people know we're putting the best of the best on our stage. That is the main goal. You know, for example, you're about to hear Brandy Younger. Man, Brandy, I just walked over to her and I said, thank you for doing the show. She did a show and we have an immersive video system and we paired a video artist with her to create this experience that's really expansive using jazz music. A lot of people don't associate us with that type of technology. And it went over like gangbusters. People are still talking about it. And so we have a bunch of shows that we're doing like that as well, because I wanted to have, we have an artist in residence program. I want to have a video artist in residence program where we pair these people together and have them create something that's very unique and different. That is all designed to satisfy the curiosity and the need of an art community. It's not just about putting butts in the seats, but at a time when our country is like so divided and we're going through so much, the arts are going to be the thing that save us. And we need to make sure that we give these artists a safe place to create their art and, you know, show it to the public.
You know, as we're talking about SF Jazz as an institution, you know, we've discussed this a bit, but I'd love to hear you also talk about what you have learned having worked now multiple times mm-hmm. with an institution like the Metropolitan Opera.
Yes.
In a historic fashion.
Mm-hmm.
But also in a way that was so powerfully transformative mm-hmm. in the sense that you brought artists and audience
yes.
to the Met that had never been there before.
Yeah,
and you asked them to mm-hmm. be themselves.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so that sounds very simple. but what an impactful and incredible gesture and process, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the interesting thing about you saying that, Nate, is that it brings me back to something that Bruce Lundvall taught me, you know, and I remember I was in his office one day, and this was when he was getting ready to sign me to the label, and he had some unreleased Clifford Brown that he played for me. No other record executive got excited about that type of stuff at that point in my career. You know what I mean? Then he started talking to me about Don Pullum and George Adams. And he was talking about how as long as he was there, they were going to be on the label because he figured they needed to have a place to document their music. So, you know, and he always talked about how, of course, there's commerce. We have to think about that. But it's like anything else. If you build something really great and really meaningful, people will show up. And that's what happened. And I have to say thank you to anybody who came to the opera, because that was what happened with that opera. You know, it wasn't necessarily, it was a moment in time. And the thing that was interesting about it was it spoke to what we're talking about right now. Man, when those dancers got up there and did that step show, man, they had like an 8-minute standing ovation. You know what I mean? And I laughed because them brothers was like, they were caught in those poses. They started to shake. They were trying to, you know, I was like, please let them go, please. You know, but I understood the reaction, because what was happening was people were seeing themselves on the stage at the Met. And when we started the process, you know, we had a meeting the first day with the entire cast, actors, dancers, singers. And it was the most powerful thing I've ever experienced in my artistic career up to that point. To listen to all of these young artists, there was a 17-year-old kid there saying how he got bullied because he just wanted to sing, right? LaTanya Moore, who's been singing for 30 years, said this is the first role in her career that she could really relate to. You know, people were talking about how they grew up singing in a church, grew up singing jazz, or grew up singing R&B, and had to turn that off to sing Puccini. And I'm like, okay, I get it, right? This ain't Puccini. This is our story. This is our culture. I want you to bring all of that back. And I'll never forget, there's an aria called Peculiar Grace that Angel Blue sang. And she came up to me before rehearsal and she said, so is it okay if I, you know, bring in some of my church? I'm like, please. And soon as she did that, there wasn't a dry eye in the room. And it wasn't just because of the way she sang it. It was because of what it represented and how we're being seen in the biggest platform in the art world, right? And I and the thing that I've been telling people, because I don't want people to get it misunderstood, I get this moniker about being the first African-American to be there, right? And I always tell them there's a big asterisk by it, because I am not the first qualified. That's the big difference. There were qualified people who didn't get the shot that I got.
William Grant Still.
William Grant Still, his name was in the book where he was rejected 3 times. And one of the quotes, I'll never forget it, it sticks in my mind, is one of the reasons why we worked hard on our productions. It said, the quote said, doesn't understand what it takes to write real opera. And that blew me away because I had just heard one of his operas in St. Louis and didn't know what it was. And I'm going, man, this is killing. What is this? And they said, oh, this is an opera by William Grant Still, written in the 30s. You know what I mean? So here it is. And here's the other part of the story that I forget to mention. In that same book of rejections, there were women's names too. So, you know, I'm glad that we get a chance to talk about this stuff because the thing that I told Peter Gale and I tell everybody, I said, man, you know, I don't want to be a token. I got to be a turnkey. You know, it's about giving everybody opportunities to tell their stories. And just by the mere fact that the people showed up in such large numbers should tell you that they are not adverse to opera. That is not the issue. The issue is what are you selling them, right? And opera itself was always the music of the people, right? It's just that it was great music and it withstood the test of time. So we tend to think that that's all it should be. And that is not the case. We have so many stories to tell. There's so many stories from other walks of life, other ethnic backgrounds, other genders that need to be told on the stage. And they have to have the room and the ability to do it.
We did some classical research at WRTI with a number of other stations around the country, and they basically came to that conclusion, which was that, you know, persons of color, actually, they don't dislike classical music.
Right.
The problem isn't them, the problem
right.
is you,
right.
basically. You know,
right, right.
Like how we
right.
how we talk about things, how we present this, mm-hmm. and also, you know, like you said, you know, how we're representing and reflecting the society that we actually live in.
Josh, let me tell you this, man. I did an interview with a journalist, and this journalist said to me, and I'm sorry, I get upset every time I think about it. He said, do you think your opera is going to inspire young black people to sing opera? And when he said that, I said, dude, people have been singing opera since opera was created. I said, you know, by the mere fact that you asked that question, let me know that you don't do your homework and you don't cover these people. And I said, the thing that's like really amazing about it, because these young, talented people have never got the due or the respect that they deserve, that they prop each other up all the time. And it's amazing to see, because I told them, I said, all you have to do is find one singer, and they will tell you about the rest of the community. When my opera went to Chicago, right? This young woman, Brittany, got the leading role. Man, do you know a bunch of those young African-American singers flew to Chicago to support her on her premiere night? That's how bad it is for them, where they have to do it themselves to kind of prop each other up. And that's, we're doing them a disservice because they are some of the most talented people on the planet. I just put it to you this way. In rehearsal, when they asked me how it goes, I never sang nothing. Not in front of them. No way. That wasn't going to happen. I said, man, so how does this go? I said, yeah, it's right there on the page.
You got it.
So a little bit earlier, right here in this tent, we had a conversation with Brandon Woody. Mm-hmm. You mentioned him as someone who's playing the festival.
Yes.
Brandon is also a new signee to Blue Note Records.
Yes.
Now, you at one point were a new signee to Blue Note Records.
Yes.
Yeah. And we're going back quite a ways. I would love to hear what you think is crucially different for an artist at that point in the trajectory now versus the early 1980s.
Well, right now, man, I feel sorry for some of the younger artists because they can't just be artists. They have to be publicists, marketing people. They have to do all of that stuff. You know, I remember when I got signed to Blue Note, and even before then when I was signed to Columbia, you know, you put out a record, you guys would put it in heavy rotation, you'd come out and do a story, and then next thing you know, I got a tour going on, right? It's hard for these young guys to do that now, and it's a big... it's hard for the record companies, to be honest. I feel sorry for all of those guys in the record industry because, you know, the streaming thing has really posed a big problem for a lot of people. But the mere fact that Brandon has gotten signed and the mere fact that he's playing these festivals is a testament to you guys because you're hearing his music and you're responding. And that's what's supposed to happen. That's our responsibility as artists. is not to be so in our head that we create music that nobody can relate to. It's not about that at all. We're out here trying to save souls, doing what we do with this art, you know? And I love that young man, you know, because he's coming with a certain type of excitement and vision, which is the most important thing. You know, he's just not out here flying around. He has a style, he has a vision in his mind, and I can't wait to see what's gonna happen to him in the near future, because he's starting out at a great place, you know, with his own sound and his own style. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you miss that feeling yourself of being like full of all that potential in your early 20s?
Because there's a lot of other stuff that comes with that, man. You know what I mean? You know,
Those kids have it then.
Yeah, the term young and dumb is real.
Yeah.
Oh my God, man, if I can go back. Yeah, I miss that if I can go back and make some corrections with some other stuff, you know?
Right.
Yeah, but no.
But that raises the question of mentorship. You know, you mm-hmm. have spoken often about Art Blakey and yes. how important he was. Mm-hmm. You cite him often.
Yes,
you know?
All the time.
And you've also, you know, had like adult mentorship situations. You know, you've been on the road with Herbie yes. for a
yeah,
while
I'm about
now,
to say I'm in
know?
One right now.
Yeah. But, yes. you know, there have been now generations of musicians who've passed through your band.
Yes.
And when they think about mentorship, they talk about you.
Mm-hmm.
So having both of those experiences, what can we say about the fundamental, you know, like the X factor in the jazz mentorship? Like, what is the most important thing for a mentor mm-hmm. to do or be?
The first thing is to tell the truth. You know, it's just to be honest with musicians, you know, based on your own experiences. And part of telling the truth is letting people know, hey, man, this is my vision. This is not the vision. You have to find your own, you know? And then the next thing is just like to constantly encourage them, you know? If young kids want to study composition, sometimes I'll sit down with them and talk to them about that. If young musicians want to talk about being on the road, I remember when Ambrose, he was struggling a little bit with the rigors of being on the road. We sat down and had a conversation about the same thing the guys have done to me. You know, like, listen, man, you got to pace yourself. When you're out here, you got to understand that there's a routine you need to do, because you got to make sure that you recover so you can make it back the next night. Like Slide Hampton, for example, when I was playing with Art Blakey, man, we play a tune, I'd always be the first one to jump out and play a solo, right? You know, and Slide called me, he put me aside and said, hey, young fella, come here, stop. He said, listen, man, you're playing a very intricate melody line that takes a lot of effort to play, right? And then you jump right into the solo. He says, you're putting a lot of wear and tear on your embouchure. He says, let somebody else take the first solo and you sit back and recover and then come back and play. Little things like that, you know, go a long, long, long way, you know, in terms of how to make sure you take care of your body on the road, being present about what you put in your body, all of those things, you know, that don't show up in a music class, you know, but that are very important. And the other part of it too is just like relating to an audience. Sometimes in the jazz world, that word is always taboo, because sometimes guys want to do what they think is hip, you know, and then hopefully have an audience digest it, right? Well, our Blake used to tell us all the time, you never want to be too hip. He said, because two hips make an ass. You know what I mean? And it's true, because, you know, you go out there and you try to do all of these things and you're not relating to anything that people have come to listen to, right? And we're here to provide a service. Just so happens, we're trying to provide the service on a high level musically, right? But it's still, you know, trying to connect with an audience and have them come away with forgetting about all of the daily doldrums and other stuff that they had to go through just to get here. Hopefully they walk away uplifted, feeling refreshed, feeling inspired about certain things. This guy was talking about Brandon's show, you know, when I was standing there talking to Brandon, and the way he walked up, I went, see, that's what I'm talking about. He walked up excited, you know, about listening to this guy. That's what it should be. You know, what else? It's not about me come, you know, doing the thing and go, man, I played some really hip shit. No, I could play really hip stuff and you go, okay, and walk away. It's a communal thing. Art Blakey always used to tell us, Never play beneath your audience. Never play above them. Just play straight to them.
In addition to your performing career, Terrence, you know, again, with this relationship that you now have with SF Jazz, you've gotten to the level now where you have the ability to shape the culture,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and I wonder, how do you think about that? How do you internalize that responsibility? And do you have certain comforts and discomforts about having that much power, whether you want it or not? It's yours.
Well, I don't think of it in those terms. I think of it like with Milt Hinton. Milt Hinton came to my high school, man, and gave a masterclass, you know, just out of the goodness of his heart and told us the truth. Clark Terry, every time I saw Clark Terry, it was a music lesson. You know, every time I saw Dizzy Gillespie, it was the same thing. You know, he'd be talking about, hey, man, you know, people play the wrong changes on the bridge to this tune, blah, 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 blah. So for me, it's about sharing the passion and love that I have for this art form with the younger generation, right? And when I see certain people have certain interests, you try to make sure that you kind of help them with that. You know, I'm always trying to tell people, listen, man, if you see me doing anything, you could be doing the same thing. I am no different than you. You know, I grew up the same way with the same amount of fears and reservations about things. It's just that you get to a certain point and you play with certain people that make you understand, stop thinking about the reservation. You know, because when you do that, that's the thing that's inhibiting you from really growing and becoming creative. Stop thinking about, you know, what people are going to say about what it is that you do. Because they, you know, most of the people that do that, they come to your gig for free anyway. You know what I mean? The main thing is to follow your heart. Because if you follow your heart, I'd say 10 times out of 10, somebody's going to feel what it is you're doing. Because we're all vibratory beings and we're all different. So we're not all going to do the same thing. And that's the beauty of it. I don't want us to. Like, you know, man, when I listen to Ambrose play, I know, I go, man, Ambrose will play some stuff. I go, dude, I never would have thought of that. But it was killing. It was beautiful. But that's the whole point of it, right? The whole point is for us not to be the same, you know? And that's, and like, again, I don't want to get into no political discussions, but when we see like the kind of stripping away of our culture, trying to make us like one thing, it really goes against our nature as human beings. You know what I mean? We need to go get back to really understanding and celebrating our differences as opposed to trying to diminish them.
We've alluded to some of the structural, financial, cultural challenges mm-hmm. on the current scene. How do you feel about the state of the art?
The state of the art is killing. Let's not make no mistake about that. There's young people who really are coming up, who really have something to say, who are going after it with a gusto. The infrastructure is the issue. That's the issue. It's like, you know, we need to have more agencies out here that are supporting the music, giving these guys, you know, a place to play and develop. Here's the thing that's like interesting about being a jazz musician, right? It's like, I'm at an age right now, you know, I'm 27, and it's all fallen into place for me in terms of music and putting together shows and all of that stuff, right? And we expect young people to do that in a very sophisticated art form. That's damn near impossible, right? They have to go through the rigors of doing shows nightly, all the time, playing in different venues, playing for audiences, having audiences respond or not respond to their music. Because let me tell you, there's a bunch of compositions I wrote early in my career, y'all didn't respond and y'all never heard them again. You know what I mean? It's just part of the thing. But that's what we need to do for the younger generation. That's the obstacle I see. I don't see no shortage of young people being interested in it. They're popping up all over the place, man. You know, and it's incredible because they're doing it at a high level. There's some young kids out there, man, that really, really can play and have something to say. So we got to make sure that when these guys are playing their music, you're supporting not only the station, but you're supporting the art form itself. Because, you know, I've been knowing these guys, like they said, I've been knowing these guys for a number of years.
And 30. He was -3 when we met.
You had to put that number out there. Huh? Yeah, I knew you figured you would do that. But the thing that I've loved about watching them is that their passion for this music has never wavered. And it's because of people like this and the people behind the scenes, the publicists, all of the other people that are involved in this community that are keeping this thing moving so you can have something to enjoy. You know, it's not just us showing up playing on the stage. So it's vital that we make sure we keep all of the support rolling, because it's really important. And think about it, you know, I'm getting to the point now. I used to be a news junkie. I can't turn on a TV now. I can't. So I'd rather listen to RTI.
Hear, hear.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful segue. There's a thing we do on the late set that we like to call This I Dig.
Uh-oh.
And obviously we are dapping Hank Mobley when we say that, but we're also checking in usually with each other.
Mm-hmm.
But today we're going to check in with you.
Mm-hmm.
We want to know what you've been digging. So one thing, a piece of music, a book, a movie, a
man, you
whatever.
Know what I've been listening to a lot of, like Michael Mayo.
Mm. Oh man, what a singer.
I don't know if you guys heard this kid, man. Go check this dude out.
Yeah. Fly is the record.
Fly is the record and Fly is off the chain. And I love it so much I had him perform with me at Jazz Fest in New Orleans.
Oh, nice.
So yeah, and we're thinking about doing some stuff in the future. But he's a musician that happens to sing. You know what I mean? This guy, his musical acumen is on a high level, and he does all of these beautiful arrangements. And when you listen to this album, Fly, one of the things I want you to check out is that it's just a trio behind him. Doesn't sound like it. I mean, there's a horn on, I think, on one of them, but and there's some guest artists, but it's basically a trio.
That's fantastic. And fun little tidbit for y'all. We did a late set episode with Michael Mayo.
Oh, good.
And in fact, he came straight from the airport off a European tour, brought his luggage to the studio, to the station and everything.
That's right.
And we talked about Fly.
Nice.
And so, yeah, so look that up.
Yes.
He's what a killer musician.
Yep.
How about a hand for Terrence Blanchard?
Hey, thank you guys.
That was cool.
So what did we tell you? A beautiful conversation with just an incredibly generous and thoughtful person. You know, Terrence is operating at the highest echelons of everything, you know? And as much as that is the case, he remains so approachable and down to earth, really.
With a deep engagement and a sense of stewardship of community.
Yes.
Knowing that about him, I feel really great about him being in the position of influence that he is, not only at SF Jazz, but writ large in the music.
Yeah, 100%. I should say, too, that concert with the E Collective at the Cape May Convention Hall was great.
It was.
It was really, really good.
Yeah.
He played some new music that has yet to be released, and that was a real treat. That band continues to evolve. And, you know, he's one of those musicians who not only is unafraid to be pushed and challenged by his band, but he insists on it. You know, it's a very Miles Davis-esque way of leading a band with a little bit of Art Blakey thrown in. We did a few of these Exit Zero jazz conversations for the late set. So you can look forward to future installments featuring the trumpeter Brandon Woody and Lucas and Zakai Curtis. All of these were just so much fun, and we can't wait to bring them to you. So stay tuned.
And now it's time to dig something.
You got to dig something.
You got to dig it to dig it, you dig.
I'll go first.
Go for it.
Are you familiar with the name Tom Skinner?
Tom Skinner. Yes, but I can't place it.
Okay. He is a drummer.
He's a drummer.
From London, I think originally from London, but that's certainly where he where he's based now. And
have I heard him on?
So you would probably know him best as a member of Sons of Kemet.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's
so he was one of two drummers in that band.
Okay.
With Shabaka Hutchings out front.
Saw them here at Underground Arts in Philly.
Oh, well, that's quite a small space to see such an uncontainable band.
It was in your face.
Yeah. So Tom is a great drummer. And since the dissolution of Sons of Kemet, his most visible appointment has been with this band, The Smile, which is Johnny Greenwood and Tom York of Radiohead. So it's the three of them. I really like The Smile. I think it's a very cool band. But Tom is also a jazz artist, and he is a band leader, composer. And he has a new album that is just out. It features a number of his collaborators on the London scene. When he talks about some of his influences, you know, his previous album, he said, was inspired by Abdul Wadud's solo cello album.
I love that record. I have
so, like, very hip reference points for him. The new one's called Kaleidoscopic Visions. And it's also very sort of shifty and chamber-like. You know, he loves cello. And so there's that in the mix. There's some woodwinds. It's a very sort of groove-oriented, but I don't know, diaphanous kind of vibe, you know, where it's like, it's not as like hard hitting as like the Micaiah McRaven thing, but it is still groovy. And I don't know, I feel like there is a distinctly London sensibility to it.
Any tuba on it?
No tuba on in this band.
Okay.
But you know that he knows how to do that. Mm-hmm. He is actually bringing this on tour. So in October, he will be in the U.S. He's got a date at Solar Myth on October 7th. And he's got slightly different personnel for the American tour than for the U.K. tour. At Solar Myth, he's going to be playing with Joshua Abrams on bass and Ingrid Laubrock on saxophone and Mai Sugimoto on alto saxophone and Ishmael Ali on cello, along with Chelsea Carmichael on tenor and flute. Chelsea's one of his London colleagues. So I hope to be there for that show. But in any case, the album is out now. I really like it. And Josh, I think you will too.
Yeah, that sounds super hip. I mentioned the tuba earlier, and there's no tuba in this, obviously. But I am digging a particular tuba because it's football season.
All right.
College football, full effect. It's Go Tigers. Dun, 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 dun. The LSU Tigers, I am going to be following religiously, of course, as I always do every year, and excited about the band.
Mm-hmm.
Tigerland, baby. Yeah, because there is a 66-year-old, I think he's 66-year-old,
all right,
student at LSU,
yep,
who is the tubaist, one of the tubaists in the band.
And he is technically a college freshman, right?
He is technically a college freshman. His name is Kent Broussard. And God bless him, man. I love it. He says, you know, like, it's like a dream deferred for him. You know, he really wanted to make it happen. And he had an entire career. And now he's back at school. And he made the band. I mean, he made it because he did the work.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, like, that's not an easy gig.
Somebody posted a picture, like a screenshot of him with the, you know, whatever, the ABC or whatever broadcast. And there was a little, you know, subtitle that said 66-year-old college freshman Kent Broussard. And he was in his band uniform, you know. And the person who posted it on social media, all he said was, that right there is the king of Louisiana.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, Kent Broussard. Where you at, Kent?
The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. It's hosted by me, Nate Chenin, with Josh Jackson.
The show is produced by Alex Arif. We also want to say special thanks to Fred Corcoran at the Exit Zero Jazz Festival for being the front of house engineer for that conversation.
We want to thank Jeff Casella at Casella Productions, Michael Klein at Exit Zero, and Elise Kingsley and Robin Burgess from Team Terrence Blanchard.
Did you enjoy this podcast? Good. I'm glad the answer is yes. If so, then hop over to the WRTI YouTube channel where you can watch this chat. How about that? We filmed it. And other performances and interviews, both jazz and classical.
On our next episode, Zakai and Lucas Curtis, the Curtis brothers, another one from Exit Zero.
Robbie Webb is our assistant production manager. Our operations and production manager is Tyler McClure, associate general manager for content and programming. That's me. And Bill Johnson is WRTI's general manager.
Stop by WRTI.org to see everything else we're cooking up here in Philadelphia and beyond. We'll see you soon.